Welcome to the Women and Wealth podcast with Esther Szabo. Esther is a respected leader in the field of personal financial advice with over 25 years of experience. After going through her own significant and challenging life-changing events, she overcame fear and self-doubt to launch her own successful advisory firm. Now Esther is ready to share her practical and personal experiences to help other women clear their hurdles and brave life's transitions. In this way, she inspires women to lead fulfilling and confident lives.
Hello and welcome to Women in Wealth with Esther Szabo from Gates Pass Advisors. Esther, how are you today?
Hi, Eric. I am doing well. You know, since now at this point of the recording, it is getting to be later in October, and I don't know when you turn the heat on. I know you're in a colder part of the world. When do you turn the heat on?
When my wife tells me to. That's the only time. I like it very cold. I'm okay with cold and cool, but she's like, no, it's 67 on the dial. Let's kick the heater on.
I'm like, okay. Yeah.
All right.
I'm sure it's hit 70. That.
Yeah.
Yeah. I bet it's hit that at this point.
It
in
did.
Nebraska.
Yeah. We turned the heater on for the first time last week. So.
Yeah. I just walked in because I do the recordings from home, and I went, oh my goodness, it's freezing in here, and it is just about 66.
That's perfect for me.
So I'm with Candy. I get her.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are we doing today?
Well, I am so excited for you to introduce our guest. We're going to talk about a topic that is way far out of the constellation of areas I usually talk mm-hmm. about as we're considering women and personal finance, but it can impact a woman in her planning. And whether it's just continuing on, well, not just, but continuing on with life or going through a divorce. And so I'm really excited for you to introduce Andrea.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I don't think you've ever covered a topic like this. So today you've got Andrea Roth on the show. And Andrea has a PhD in art history and has been in the art field for close to 30 years as an academic, gallery administrator, and art appraiser. She is Roth Fine Art Appraisal's principal appraiser and supervises all appraisal functions at the company. She specializes in European and American paintings and sculptures and is an accredited senior appraiser with the American Society of Appraisers, also known as the ASA. That's a great bio, Esther. Now, I know why you brought on the show, because you guys are talking art today, right?
We are talking art and how it can impact somebody's planning. So I'm going to turn it, Andrea. It's so great to have you. I'm so excited for this conversation. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Esther. Such a pleasure to be here.
Well, great. Why don't you share a little bit more about what you do? It is a fabulous bio, and how you came into this line of work.
Well, it was a little bit intimidating to hear you say 30 years experience, although it is true. It makes me feel really old.
I'm right there with you.
So I have an independent art appraisal and art consulting business. I like to say that I protect people's treasures. Have you ever wondered about that painting hanging over your parents' fireplace? Have you inherited artwork or antiques and you don't know anything about them? Have you purchased artwork several years ago and wonder what they're worth today in today's market? Can you replace them if you had to today? So this is the kind of work that I do. I do valuations for paintings and sculptures, antiques, decorative objects, for a variety of reasons, including insurance coverage, estate planning, charitable donation, divorce settlement. And I like to educate people about the values of their personal belongings and treasures so that they can make knowledgeable decisions.
I mean, it's so important and it's so helpful to know that someone with your skills is available. Can you talk a little bit about, say, for example, when you come in, you're asked to provide an appraisal during an estate settlement or a divorce. Can you talk about those two instances and what it's like from, you know, what do you do?
Yeah. So many times when there's been a death in the family and beneficiaries have inherited some potentially valuable pieces and they don't know what to do with them. Maybe they haven't had a conversation with their family, with their parents, with their grandparents, and they have no idea what they have. So they'll call me. Number one, I oftentimes will get called by the estate planning attorney because they need to do a valuation for the estate tax purposes, and we need to value all the personal property. So that's one time that I get involved. And another time is when the beneficiaries have inherited and they just don't know what to do. So I really like to work with people and help them get unstuck and help them make some decisions. They need to know how to equitably divide paintings, antiques, decorative objects among the brothers and sisters and rest of the beneficiaries. And maybe they just decide, you know, these were nice in my parents' home, but they don't really fit into my decor. I'm not interested in keeping them. What do I do? Are they really valuable? Can I sell them and make some money off of them? Should I donate them and get the tax write-off? So that's the kind of advice that I give in terms of estate planning purposes. Mm-hmm. And many times it is women that I work with because they are more often than not the surviving spouse and right. need to make some decisions. Sometimes it's downsizing and moving into a smaller home. And I really love giving that kind of advice and collaborating with them and their overall financial team. And then in the case of a divorce, it's a similar type of work where the couple that is divorcing needs to make decisions about who gets what so that there is an equitable division. And they hire me to do that and understand the market for their work and understand what the most relevant marketplace is in which these things sell. And so those are the two different cases that I get involved in that sense.
And then our last podcast guest was, I know you know her well, Dairy Wisdom. So insurance is another yes. really important part of this. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So Dairy and I have worked together quite a bit, and she's wonderful. She really understands the insurance industry so well. So for insurance, what we want to make sure is that people can replace what they have in the event of a loss. You know, we live in fire country out here, mm-hmm. and so many people have lost their precious, valuable commodities, painting, sculpture, et cetera, in the fire. And what happens if they don't have anything scheduled? And let's say they don't have to worry about an appraisal, but do they even have things documented? So mm-hmm. what I do is I make sure ahead of time that people's collections are well protected to minimize the risk of a complete loss and the inability to get compensated. So I am in a good sense called in ahead of time to do the appraisal and to bring things up to current market value. And this is an important distinction to make between a replacement value for insurance and a fair market value for the estate mm-hmm. tax or estate planning purposes. Sometimes those values are quite different, and sometimes the marketplace in which I use to get my data is quite different. But that's the idea behind insurance is should there be a loss, we want the owner to be able to go to most convenient venue and be able to replace it with a comparable piece in the marketplace. And what would that cost be? So that's what I do for insurance coverage.
What creates the differential between the insurance amount and the fair market value?
Well, it's really the fair market value is an IRS definition. And mm-hmm. that basically means what would it cost to sell this object between a willing buyer and a willing seller without having any other restrictions in the marketplace. So in a very simplified way to think about it, it's more like a wholesale or secondary market value most of the time, but not always. I know there's a lot of but in that. But okay. for replacement value is you should be able to go in and replace it usually in a retail market. So like through a dealer and pay full price. That's what the insurance company would expect. But fair market value for the estate is should you have to dissolve the estate, what could you actually get for it in the open marketplace? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And what you're saying is if you needed to replace it in one case, what mm-hmm. would you expect to pay to replace it?
Exactly.
And the other is if you needed to value it, what's a valuation that the IRS would accept that makes sense?
Yeah, yeah. Should you have to sell it rather than buy it?
Got it. Okay, I was missing that piece. And then for charity, when people donate to charity, I imagine it's the fair market value issue because that's an IRS issue. And then how do people pick the charities that they want to donate to? That's a little bit different and maybe not really in your alley, but I'm sure you have so much experience. Like, how do people select the charity that they would like to donate their piece to?
Yeah, well, so I'll give you an example. We had a case where I did evaluation for a woman who was in her 80s, whose husband passed. And she between her and her husband through marriage, they had 7 children together. And they had a variety of quite valuable artwork, but only one of the children was an art collector and really knew the art market, and there were maybe 2 or 3 pieces in there that were ultra, ultra valuable in the millions of dollars, where the rest of the items were, you know, not inexpensive, but certainly not of that caliber. And so in order to make things equitable and to not give an unfair advantage to the one child who was knowledgeable about the art market, she wanted to remove those 3 paintings from her estate and donate them.
Oh, wow.
So that way, the rest of the artwork was, you know, relatively of equal value, and each child could choose. They had a method that they established as to, you know, who took what turn to choose whatever they wanted. Anyway, so she came to me to help her decide where to donate them. And so what I did is I helped her choose an institution. It was a museum that wasn't too large, that really would covet this piece and would be assured to display it. Because many times when you donate things to a very prestigious museum, it just ends up getting placed in storage and never really displayed. And that's a shame. Mm-hmm. So in order for her to have the pride of having, you know, donated this beautiful piece that this museum would really covet in their collection, we chose to give to a small university museum rather than a large, maybe more internationally prestigious museum. And they were thrilled. And she got the same tax write-off. And not only that, but it happened to be the alma mater of her recently deceased husband.
Oh, wow.
So there was that kind of connection, you know,
right,
a link between her husband and where he went to school, and that they were, you know, presenting these beautiful artifacts to a museum that would really appreciate and covet them. So to answer your question, it really depends. You know, I try to speak with the potential donor, ask what their intentions are, and try to match them up with a museum that really makes sense. That particular museum didn't have a lot of artwork by these particular artists. And so, again, that was a reason for them to be really excited about it, rather than to say, well, you know, I donated to the Met Museum in New York. Well, great, but it may never be displayed, you know.
Right.
So there are, you know, everybody has different purposes and different intentions about charitable giving.
I love that you know, that's an additional value that people might not consider is, you know, there really is a lot of personal finance. And I love that was the connection with the husband, and that their, you know, their family could continue. 7 children, there must be at least one grandchild there, and that they can continue to go and appreciate these pieces and also connect with their fathers, grandfathers, husbands, alma mater as well, in their personal history. That's
exactly.
What a great value.
Exactly.
So yeah, I have to ask,
I think that was special.
Is that in terms of the only thing that I could relate to with this is I think of Antiques Roadshow, which I kind of am embarrassed to bring up, because what you do is, I know, perhaps more elevated, if you will, but that's all the only thing I can relate this to is somebody brings you a piece and you review and tell them about it, and then ta-da. So how do you compare what you do? I know it's not necessarily antiques, it's artwork and sculpture, et cetera, but how do you compare you do with that?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's not terribly different, only that Antiques Roadshow has created the assumption that we just pull these figures out of the top of our head, which couldn't be further from the truth. Because, you know, even in Antiques Roadshow, they've had this object that's being valued for usually a few days to a week. So they've had a team of experts who have been doing some research on it and are able to ultimately, you know, give a range of values. So the difference between what I do is that when I go into someone's home, I can't possibly point my finger and say, oh, $10,000, $2,000, $50,000. No, I can't do that. And when I've even tried, I oftentimes will be wrong, just because you really need to do the appropriate research. So typically what an appraisal assignment entails is that I make an appointment with my client, I go to their home, and I do what's called the on-site inspection, and I catalog each piece. So I confirm who the artist is, I assess condition, I take dimensions, I take photographs, I compile all the cataloging information, and then I do my research back at the office, which takes several weeks depending on the size of the project. And what I do is I accumulate comparables. I try to find other objects of like kind and quality in the marketplace and compare them and rank them and look at best, better, worse. You know, how does my object compare to others out there? What are the characteristics of value of this particular artist's work? Is he a landscape painter? Is she a portrait painter? And how does that relate to other images out there in the marketplace that are of like kind and quality? So it's not like unlike real estate, you know, the methodology is very similar, but it's all about using the appropriate marketplace and understanding what the characteristics are for each artist, because those vary.
Have you ever had clients who were disappointed by the appraisals, thought it would be so much more, or who were surprised and happily surprised by the appraisals, or for clients or for you?
Yeah, I have. I have several situations that I can cite where, you know, I've gone into someone's home and I look at a painting that, you know, doesn't immediately impress me too much. And the family thinks it's, you know, an average object. They think it has some value. And then as I do my research, and this happened not too long ago, I was absolutely dumbfounded. And to maintain confidentiality, I can't give the name of the artist because it would probably be really obvious who it is. But suffice it to say, this was there were four paintings by the same artist. And as I did my research, and it took a lot of investigating because auction records were kind of all over the map. There were some sales at about $10,000, $50,000, one sale for $250,000. That's a huge range. And I'm thinking, what do I do with this information? And as I dug more and as I consulted expert dealers and experts in the market for this artist's work, I learned that each piece ranged between $1.3 million and $1.7 million. And they had four of them. I mean, wow. It was unbelievable. I had never encountered something like this that shocked me to that degree and shocked the family, you could imagine. Because now we're talking about an entirely different estate planning situation, right? We went from thinking they were maybe $10,000 each or something to $1.3 million to $1.7 million. So that was huge. Now that doesn't happen very often, but when it does, you know, it's incredibly valuable information. And then I've had other situations where people have had extremely well-known artists in their collection. And I'm going to bring up the situation of bronzes, for example, because you have some, you know, artists who are household names in the art world, like Edgar Degas or Frederick Remington, right? And they're painters as well as sculptors, and they make bronze. Well, the name of the foundry makes a huge difference in the value. So these particular individuals, they thought that they had some extremely valuable pieces. And it turns out that where these were cast made the difference between a $200,000 sculpture and a $15,000 sculpture by the same artist. Huge
difference. Why does that make a difference?
Well, in this particular case, the foundry that was in the $15,000 range had taken some plaster casts after the artist passed away. And it's not so much that they weren't authenticated casts, but the people in the field of this artist's, let's say the historians, who are the market makers and who bless the work, did not feel that this was a fully validated foundry, and that the castings were not authorized, let's say, by the estate and the family. And so that's all it took. And auction houses like Sotheby's and Christie's won't touch them. You might find them for sale with smaller local regional French French auction houses, or other European, I should say, not just French. But it makes a huge difference. And so you can imagine, you know, big disappointment among the owners who thought that they had an original. Mm. And it's not that it's not an original, it's just it's the casting,
right.
Because a bronze is always, you know, a multiple anyway. So these are just important. We got to do our due diligence as appraisers, you know. You got to kind of continue digging until you're not turning anything up. We're real detectives in that sense.
And what, you know, that brings up the issue of, have you encountered where something was fraudulent or a fake, or how do you get to that?
Yeah, you know, we as appraisers are not authenticators, and the world of authentication is just fraught with all sorts of potential liabilities, and even artists' estates in many cases no longer will officially authenticate something. So in some cases. So it's complicated. What we do is, one of the first questions we always ask is, where did you get it? Where did it come from? How far can we trace the provenance or history of ownership? And so that's what we do when we do our due diligence. We try to trace the object to the original owner or the hand of the artist, if possible. Now, depending on how old that is, you know, that may or may not be possible. But whenever something doesn't quite smell right to us, then we bring in an expert. We try to find out who is the authority on this particular artist's work. And it's usually a scholar. And we ask them to review it for us and take a look. Because as generalist appraisers, we can't possibly know everything. And we can't possibly be able to authenticate and offer that degree of expertise on every single piece out there. So a good appraiser has a solid network of colleagues on whom we can reach out to and consult with and rely on for their expertise. And that's what we usually do. And there have been cases, you know, there are certain artists, you hear the word Salvador Dali prints, and that's just stop. No more. Because they're so problematic. And so many were printed after his death without any kind of authorization. And so there are certain red flags that we look for. And when we see it, we always communicate those to our clients and try to steer them in the path of trying to figure out, you know, who is it possible to even authenticate it? And it's it could be a very expensive endeavor, because the estates charge money. Many of them are in Europe, and you have to send it to them. And so it's not a cheap thing. It can take you on a very costly path.
Well, what recommendations would you have for people who, we talk about this too on the planning side, just in terms of keeping house cost basis and things like that, to just keep current records? What do you recommend for people keeping current records about their items and artwork?
Yeah. So for things that they did not purchase themselves, and things that they've inherited or are potentially to inherit, to have those conversations with their family members to see if they know where great-grandmother eventually, you know, acquired this. Well, what was her circle? What was her network? Try to get that oral history from our family members that could translate that for us and write it down and scan it and save it on a cloud-based server somewhere with your family records. And if they're things that you've purchased yourself, then never throw away the documents. And certainly don't just shove them in a drawer. The best thing to do is to scan them on your phone. There are all sorts of fantastic, easy to use apps these days. You can scan any document on your phone and then save it on a cloud-based server. That's the minimal thing that you can do. And minimal number two actually is take photos of everything. Make sure that you have a photo of absolutely everything. And even if you don't want a photo of everything, take room shots. And don't forget the cabinets. Open up all the cabinets in your kitchen and pantry, wherever you might have silver and crystal and dinnerware, because all of those are can be valuable and should be protected. So that's at the very least that I tell people to do, to create some sort of a list if possible, scan their invoices and take photographs. Because if you have an insurance claim, how are you going to prove what you own when your house just went up in flames and all your documents with it? So you have nothing to prove it. Of course, it's always best to have the appraisal, because the appraisal then brings everything up to market value. Because if you have a purchase receipt from 1990, who's to say that that object is still valued the same in 2021? Mm-hmm. So the appraisal brings everything up to date. And then having that kind of documentation will expedite insurance claims, will help beneficiaries make decisions, will facilitate long-term planning. It just makes everything so much easier.
And with that, it's true. I mean, even keeping paperwork in a drawer, there is the thing, well, what about a fireproof safe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
And they're not super fireproof, I think.
Well, yeah, you know, someone like Derry would be able to weigh in a little better than I can on that. I mean, I think that's certainly better than putting them in a drawer, without a doubt. But it's so easy to just scan documents these days, you know? And I'm a big believer in that. I've tried to do that with my own documents. And now even in my office, we are, I would say, 85 to 90% paperless. So I'm trying to do everything digitally. I've got an iPad and I've got my computer and I've got my phone. And between those three things, you know, we work really efficiently that way. And I'm not so worried about a loss in the same way.
And I imagine it's also really easy to share all of that information with, whether it's the legal team or the tax team, as well as the other teams that you use for resources for appraisal.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. And, you know, for people who are a little more sophisticated, I have clients who, you know, we do inventories as well for them. So we will put all the contents on a collection management database. Mm-hmm. And that's really great, because there, for a serious collector who potentially might loan a work of art to a museum, or might have something at the restoration studio, or might have something at the framer. So you can track where these are located. And maybe you have some things in your vacation home in the mountains, and maybe your other vacation home in the desert. And so, you know, for sophisticated clients who really do have a vast art collection that spans multiple locations, there's really no substitute. I mean, we do that a lot for people. There are lots of cloud-based artwork collection management services that we use. And it's a game changer for them.
Well, thank you, Andrea, so much for all of this information. It's just so, no pun intended, valuable to talk with you, because you give so much more insight than what I certainly understood prior to our conversation, where it was the Antiques Roadshow kind of framework. And you show so much more of the sides to this, all the different tips around saving and record keeping and considerations for future generations and giving, and what the possibilities are for in terms of valuation, and knowing and learning more about the pieces. So thank you so much, Andrea. I really appreciate all that you shared with us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Esther. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate. It's been fun for me. I love sharing my passion for this. And I just really believe that knowledge is power, right?
Yes.
And the more you know, the better decisions you can make, and the more you plan ahead, the more prepared you are. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's my theme. I always feel like we could talk longer, but I'm going to turn it over to Eric. So Eric, do you have any of those like dog poker playing art pieces that you would like to talk to Andrea about?
No, here's the thing, Andrea, you kind of joked about, oh, it kind of made me feel old. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've been working in a medium for well over 30 years. It's Crayola. I don't know if you're familiar, but now that I have grandkids, I'm really getting much better than I was 10, 15 years ago, but I'm still, my wife won't let me hang them on the fridge. So we'll talk about that later. That's a whole nother session. I just want to thank you so much for being on the show. Another thing that you said that I keyed in on was when you have those aha moments or those moments that maybe something has been appraised for higher than the family thought, you said that's an estate planning issue now, right? I mean, that changes things. And so I know, Esther, that's one of the things that you do really well with folks is that you work with folks that are in transition, and that would be a major transition from thinking something was worth $10,000 to $15,000 or $50,000. All of a sudden it's, you know, $1.5 million. So I think you guys are making obviously a great team in this kind of scenario. So I'm really appreciative that you brought Andrea on the show. And of course, we want to say thank you to you last, our listening audience. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the Women in Wealth podcast with Esther Szabo. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when Esther comes out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. This makes it really easy to share these podcasts with your friends and family. Again, thanks for listening today. For everyone at Gates Pass Advisors, this is Eric Johnson reminding you to live your best day every day. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Women and Wealth podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you receive notifications of new podcasts as they become available. Check out the website at www.gatespassadvisors.com for more information. This content is developed from sources believed to be providing accurate information. The information in this material is not intended as tax or legal advice. Please consult legal or tax professionals for specific information regarding your individual situation. The opinions expressed and material provided are for general information and should not be considered a solicitation for the purchase or sale of any security.